Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I am talking to an extraordinary crop breeder, the only person I've managed to find who is doing intergeneric hybridization. So, Weston Adams, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself and how you came into the crop breeding world?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So I grew up doing gardening. My dad, we got permission from the landlord to till up the front and the backyard. So our house was surrounded in gardens. So I grew up, really, really enjoying agriculture. And I ended up studying sustainable food and farming. I went to UMass, actually took an online program through UMass Amherst here in the States. And I worked at a farm in California for a summer. I worked at a tropical plant distributor down in Arkansas. And most recently, I've been helping out with some plant development at Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company.
Brilliant, brilliant. So let's dive right into this because I'm so excited to talk about it. Well, firstly, with crop breeding, what are your broad priorities? Like, what are you trying to achieve in general when you work with a crop?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, kind of what got me into crop breeding was my interest in fruit. So this was a few years back, and I was really interested in persimmons. They're here in the States, persimmons are probably the lowest input fruit item that you can grow. There are a lot of air, well, I should say in our part of the United States, there are parts of the country, California, other parts of the world where a lot of the traditional apples and peaches grow really well, but here in our area, they require a lot of inputs, a lot of pesticides. So I was getting into the low maintenance fruit trees and specifically into persimmons and persimmon breeding. That was a few years ago. And about that time is when I took a job offer at a Baker Creek Seeds here. And that was the beginning of annuals and biennial crop breeding. I kind of transitioned into annuals and biennials. And I would say that as far as goals, working here at a seed company, we have an interesting view on the seed market. Our company is more focused on home gardeners. So we're mainly marketing to the home gardener. That means that we are a little more free in our crop breeding pursuits. We don't have to breed for the uniformity and the shipping quality that maybe a traditional crop breeder would breed for. So I would say our goals and what we're doing is a huge thing is ornamental appeal, new novel ornamental phenotypes. That's a huge thing. We're also breeding for nutrition qualities, which in some cases overlaps with ornamentals. When you get into like the anthocyanins, you get nutrition quality overlapping with ornamental value. Disease resistance, that's another big thing. So it's pretty broad. And I would say that we kind of do opportunity breeding here. We're looking at, that's what I'm involved with. We're looking for opportunities. What do we see growing in the garden that looks cool? What do we see a new mutation? Do we see a new natural cross? Or do we see a trait that we could introgress into, another line of a species?
Brilliant, brilliant. I'm so excited to talk about your, when we get to the end, about how Baker Creek as an organization, functioning as a company in the seed market today, deals with all of the pressures, because it's a shrinking market from some perspectives. Like it's not an easy business to make it work. And Baker Creek has been around for quite a while. So yeah,
yes,
we'll have to,
yes.
We'll have to make a note to get back and talk a bit more about that too.
Yeah, for sure.
So tell me about some of your crop breeding projects, and where I really want to start, so we leave plenty of time for it, is your work doing intergeneric hybridization.
Yeah, intergeneric, that was something we kind of stumbled upon this year. I've tried a few different intergeneric hybrids. The only ones that I have really dug deeper into are in the Asteraceae family. And I would say that one of the reasons I've been able to dive deeper into that is because there are male sterile lines of sunflowers of different Asteraceae, mainly sunflowers is what I've been working with. And those male sterile lines allow for much easier intergeneric hybridization because you're able to mass apply pollen from your pollen donor and totally exclude the possibility of self-pollination. The other thing is that, which is probably why I focused on the Asteraceae family, is because the flower heads, the head structure, is the florets are positioned in such a way that it's easy to, in one sitting, generate 300 crosses because you've all got all those individual little florets in the larger head. So, if I was working in another crop, which, we're starting to dabble in, like the Solanaceae, if I was working in one of those other crops, it would take me, all day to do what I can do in 10 minutes or half an hour in the Asteraceae family. So that's one reason I've focused there.
I'm guessing too, the structure of the flower helps. If you've got something like a cucurbit female flower and it only sets one or two viable embryos, that may not be enough to encourage it to develop into a full fruit. I think there's hormonal signaling that comes from the seeds that causes it to attach, and you need to get a reasonable number of embryos to get it to mature. Whereas with an Asteraceae, because all of those little seeds are separate from each other, they are viable individually. So I'm guessing you occasionally get a sunflower head that just has like four or five fully formed seeds that fall out of it.
Yeah, that's common. With this kind of work, we're looking for just the, sometimes one seed in a sunflower head because it's we're working with such, genetically distinct crop types, pollen donors and seed parents. So for sure.
So, which other species have you tried crossing? Which other genera have you tried crossing onto sunflowers?
I've tried a lot. We've used a single male sterile sunflower line for most of our work. And then we have brought in pollen from zinnia. We've brought in pollen from cosmos, from echinacea. We've brought in pollen from, and I'm spacing on the Latin name, but the straw flower we've brought in. And there have been others. We brought in some from Rudbeckia. So we've tried a lot. We've just thrown a whole lot of different pollen at this male sterile sunflower line. And we've gotten mixed results. So with the zinnia sunflower hybrids, we've gotten confirmed hybrids 100%. Anyone would look at them and know this is a hybrid. But what we've dealt with is there's like some hybrid necrosis. Like the plant, you've got, incompatible genome sets in there. And the way I see it is it's almost like the genomes are, shall we say, fighting each other on almost an immune response to one another. There may be, I'm sure people have researched the mechanisms more than that, but that's the way it appears to me. The plants struggle, they're very small. So we are experimenting with some ways to get around that. Hormone treatment is something that we're interested in using. Another thing is grafting those ne necrotic hybrids onto one of the parent species. So there are ways that, there's literature about it, and it talks about different ways that have worked in other crops. So we're experimenting with some of that.
Now, before I move on too much, how did you find the idea of doing this kind of wide intergeneric crossing? Like, were there particular papers or resources or examples?
Yeah, actually, there's a body of literature that's been generated, over a pretty good time period. I think a lot of it came from Russia, and they've generated these hybrids before. Now, there's been a lot of debate as to whether some of them are true hybrids, because, you can always get the stray sunflower grain that, you're sucking pollen off of your pollen parent, but you might have had a bee visit that pollen parent before and, deposit a sunflower grain. So you've got all these unknowns, and there's been a lot of debate as to whether they're real hybrids. And honestly, right now we've got probably 20 hybrids growing. We know the seed parent because we harvested the seed. They were pollinated by these different genera, and we've gotten a wide array of phenotypes coming out of that. Some of them look very similar to the seed parent, Some of them have some anthocyanin in the stem, anthocyanin accumulation in the stem. Some of them, when they first sprouted, they had leaves that anyone looking on would have said, that's a hybrid. But then as they've developed, they've shifted back toward sunflower. We've gotten a wide range of products out of this, and we're still doing research on some of them.
Yeah. A comparable project that comes to mind, Luther Burbank, in one of his
Yeah.
many projects, had a female native raspberry that was the only raspberry that he had in that area. And he put pollen on it from everything else he had in the rosaceae. So
Oh,
apples
yeah.
and pears and just everything he could get rosaceae pollen, he put on this thing. And I think he generated 40 intergeneric hybrids.
Oh,
And
wow. Yeah.
it was just this huge like thicket of all of these bizarre like plants that didn't know quite what they were.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Yeah, it's so strange.
it's more possible than people realize, but you just need to set up the circumstances to bring in the wide pollen and prevent self-pollination with the same species. And if you can
For
set that
sure. And
up, yeah, if you can
I
set
think
that up, you can do a
something that,
lot.
yeah. And I think something that people need to keep in mind is a chromosome elimination. That happens in certain species when you apply incompatible pollen, the zygote will eliminate the paternal chromosomes, and you end up with a haploid plant because the paternal chromosomes are not compatible. And that's something we're starting to look into, because I think we may have some of that going on in this, which is, it's to be expected, because these are very, very dissimilar genuses we're working with.
Now, I wonder, do you have any thoughts about the logistics of doing this kind of controlled pollination? So, but for some plants, you might be forced to do emasculation, which is never works perfectly. So you'll have some self-pollinated seeds coming through the program. But I'm more
Yeah.
interested in like lining up the availability of pollen from other species or other genera that may not be flowering at the same time as the maternal parent.
Yeah, and we're actually starting to experiment with freezing pollen right now. This is our first year working, intergenerically, and we went to a lot of pains to line up our flowering times. So we had fresh pollen from our paternal parents to apply to our seed parents. Now, if I could do it over, I would probably grow the paternal parents in a greenhouse, because one, they produce a lot more pollen. The bees don't rob it, because the bees rob a lot. You'd be amazed. I was amazed at how much they rob. So you grow them in a greenhouse and you don't deal with that. And the other thing is, when you're collecting pollen, you know that it's pure, because you haven't had insects bringing in, depositing foreign pollen grains onto those heads. So a lot of this work is about eliminating question marks. So if you grow it in a greenhouse, you can just eliminate that many more question marks and have a little more control over what's happening.
So, were you doing staggered sowing of the pollen parent species so that, because with a lot of annual daisies, you get kind of like a peak of flowering at a fairly
Yeah, for sure.
predictable time after sowing?
We were staggering our pollen parents. Even more importantly, I think we were staggering our seed parents. So we had seed parents, a few of them coming on pretty much all summer. So then when we had our big flush, because we're on a farm here, we've got pretty much all the pollen parents already growing on the farm. So if we stagger our seed parents, then we're bound to get some overlap. So that's more what we did.
Do you think it would be possible to plant some pollen sterile sunflowers and then just have a huge garden of other Asteraceae around them and just wildcard it, like anything, any pollen that manages to produce hybrids, and let the bees do all
Yeah.
of the fiddly work?
I think that would be neat. Probably I would eliminate, you'd have to eliminate all the other male fertile sunflowers in the mix. But if you didn't have any, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what you got. You may honestly not get anything, just from my experience, because the compatibility is so low. We would apply, we'd mass apply millions of grains of pollen, and you might get, two seeds in a sunflower head. So There's definitely possibility there. I don't know if you get seeds or not. You just have to try it.
I think I recall as well that bees, individual bees, have flower preferences. So
Oh,
some of the
yeah.
bees might spend all their time on the sunflowers, and other bees spend all their time on the other flowers, and there isn't
Yeah.
necessarily much being moved between them, which is interesting
Yeah.
to think about why they do that. But anyway, have you thought about potentially inducing polyploidy in your hybrids to maybe restore vigor or fertility?
You know, inducing polyploidy is something that is, it can be helpful. You know, it happens, it does happen in nature. You know, at Baker Creek here, we really, you know, we take efforts to make sure we're doing things natural. We're not doing any genetic engineering. We're not doing mutation breeding. But polyploidy is something that does happen in nature. It can be induced using natural chemicals. And so it's something that we would consider under the right circumstances. We have experimented with it a little bit. Actually, we've experimented with it more for generating polyploids in the parental lines. You know, I know you can also do that in the hybrid offspring, and we may need to do that at some point. But yeah, it's definitely a tool.
I recently saw an alternate method that uses glutamate, so like MSG. You
Yes,
can
yes.
soak tissues in MSG, and it's less toxic than eryzalin, which is a natural plant chemical, but it's a bit toxic. And eryzalin is less toxic than colchicine, another natural plant chemical, but it's quite toxic. If you're handling pure colchicine, you have to be careful.
And you know, while we're on this topic, there's a paper I recently looked at that it documents natural polyploid induction in solanaceous, mainly it's tomato species this is looking at. And they were growing seedlings to, oh, I want to say 2 inches, 1.5 inches tall, and then just severing them all, severing all the seedlings off. And you know, with tomato species, they generate a lot of callus tissue at that cut, and they'll regenerate like adventitious shoots. And in these studies, 10% of those adventitious shoots forming from the callus tissue were tetraploids. So there's some nuclear fusion that happens. So we're doing that actually right now. That's, you know, a natural way to generate those polyploid lines.
Now, let me think. Are there any other insights or possibilities that you think might be coming from this intergeneric hybridization?
You know, we're working with a lot of these different combinations. My hope is that some of these lines we're growing out have introgressed a few chromosomes from the parental species. That's my hope. I definitely think there's a lot of potential in intergeneric hybridization, but you know, as I've heard it said before, it's high-hanging fruit. So you have to be, you know, because you have to, in order to say anything, in order to have any data to go off of, you have to generate such high quantities of crosses. You know, you might try one tactic, but until you try it 100 times, you can't really say anything about it. So it compounds on itself as far as the effort involved, but it can be rewarded. You know, that high-hanging fruit is valuable fruit if you're willing to put in the work. So we're starting to work on dabble in that more and more because tap into that potential.
I like to think of it that run-of-the-mill biotechnology, we want it to be like a machine, that it does exactly what you want every time you press the button, it turns on, job
Yeah.
done. But
Yeah.
this kind of high risk, high reward work, it's more like a miracle. Like it might only
Yeah.
happen like once in 1,000 tries. But if it happens in a way that produces an organism that is viable, that can go on to reproduce itself, it's more like a miracle. It's something that happens so rarely, but it still has this huge impact ever afterwards. So
Yeah, it does.
I find that really exciting.
Yeah. And you look at, you know, you look at in the past, you know, they've had breakthroughs. I'm thinking about like the tomatoes, all the black skin tomatoes. Now that was an interspecific. That wasn't so much intergeneric,
But still
but
difficult.
same concept. Yeah.
And probably the domestication of wild species went through a similar, like, highly unlikely chance
Yeah, for sure.
event. And someone just happened to be in the right place at the right time to pick it
Yeah,
up and
yeah.
run with it.
Yeah,
Do
for
you
sure.
Do you have any other breeding projects that really stand out? Because we chatted before, and you've got a lot of them on the go.
Yeah, we're working, opportunity breeding. We've got so many things that we're dabbling in. We've got some tomato lines we're working on. Actually, Nicholas Morneau, you may know that name. He was working with a dark green tomato mutant. So we've been continuing some of the work that he had going on that dark green tomato mutant, trying to generate a line that has the green when ripe phenotype combined with the dark green recessive trait. So, you get a dark green ripe tomato. So we're still working on that.
Does that have some pest resistance advantages, like birds are less likely to pay attention to them?
You're probably right, because I know that in cherries that's that way. You get the yellow cherries and they don't get the pest pressure nearly as much. So yeah, we've been working on some dehybridizing, taking F1s and working through those unstable generations and coming up with OP lines that have desirable traits and characteristics. So we've been doing some of that with watermelons and with melons, mainly those two, with the watermelons and melons. Sunflowers is something just traditional, Helianthus annuus, not intergeneric stuff, but sunflowers was something we started last year. And we actually crossed a full teddy bear type sunflower to a full red. And those F1s went down to Florida for the winter. And then we got back the F2s in the spring. And I wish I could share with you some pictures, because it's been a kaleidoscope that's come out of those. So we're working on ramping up those seeds, and hopefully we can get it to the market pretty fast. Right now is a mix, but we're also working on selecting some color lines out of that mix. So yeah, those are a few examples. Yeah.
Have you thought? I'm only asking this because I'm so jealous about the genetic resource you have of Helianthus in North America. Have you thought about tapping into all of the wild species that are, often perennial or have really different growth forms in that part of the world to incorporate them into annuus to see what could happen?
I have friends who are doing that. I have not done it myself. Outside of Helianthus annuus, I have not. But I have friends who are doing it, and I'm definitely interested to see, what they get out of their stuff. We have grown some wild forms of Helianthus annuus, still the same species. We've tapped into the USDA germplasm. They've got a pretty large repository. But yeah, I'm eager to see what my friends get, because some of them are working with some of those other, yeah, some of those perennial lines.
Are there any strains of sunflower which are relatively resistant to small bird pest pressure?
We have not grown them. If so, we've mainly been working with sunflowers the last 2 years, and ours, we bag them. We bag the heads that are important, because the bird pressure is an issue. So I would, we have some growers that are growing sunflower seed for us in areas where they don't have bird pressure, which is really nice. But for those of us who do, I have not yet seen a line that's resistant to birds, but that would definitely be something worth exploring, evaluating germplasm for that.
It's something on my very long to-do list. We have a local seed gene bank here that I can tap into that has hundreds and hundreds of sunflower accessions with no descriptions. So
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
is there something in there that could be useful to help me have a chance of getting a crop past my very, very large bird pressure problems? And I'm also interested in crossing sunflower with Tithonia, the shrubby Tithonia diversifolia,
Oh,
to maybe,
yes.
yeah,
Yes, yes.
the dream there would be to make a perennial seed sunflower that you don't have to resow every year.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's
Speak.
a neat dream.
Speaking of that question, do you have like a dream crop that you would love to create that, no barriers, like you could live for 1,000 years if it took to get the work done?
Oh, a dream crop. I would love to see some more color variation within Helianthus annuus specifically. That's kind of what drove some of these intergeneric hybrids. I would love to see the blue tones in zinnias. I would also love to see more variation within tomato species. We're growing right now, we're growing like about 10 different wild tomato species, but even within those, there's a limited array of fruit colors. So I would love to see more diversity when it comes to phenotypes in the solanaceous crops.
Brilliant. I can just see that the blue that you get in like chicory flowers,
Yes, for
there's nothing
sure.
like it. Imagine that in a sunflower.
Yeah, and that would be a long project because you've got that yellow background in sunflowers, which you would almost have to get rid of before you'd have the blue showing through. So they've got some of the pollenless varieties that are white, nearing white. They're still cream colored. They're nearing white, but as far as pure white, that's another target in the helianthus.
Lovely. I can just imagine it. Now, next, I normally talk about how people work with low input. And I get the impression with Baker Creek, because they're a commercial production company, they probably use fairly high input methods to get like a reliable amount and quality of the output of the seed.
Inputs, part of it depends on where you're growing as far as how much inputs you need. Here on our farm, we are grateful because our soil fertility is such that we do require some inputs, but we can rely largely on organic inputs, and we're able to minimize like synthetic inputs. We do use some, but we're able to minimize a lot of those. Are you referring like mainly to fertility inputs, or are you thinking more of like pest
And
control?
irrigation too, and irrigation as
Oh
well.
yes, irrigation. Yeah. Irrigation, we use drip typically on our farm, so everything's on drip irrigation. We do live in a high rain, a high annual precipitation part of the country. So for us, I would say that the larger input that we're really trying to get around is the input of plastic mulch, because we've got this very high weed pressure. Anywhere that has a lot of rain has high weed pressure. This year we were experimenting with some biodegradable plastic mulch, and that's helpful, but there's still more improvement to be done, I think, in the biodegradable mulch department, so that people can reliably control their weeds and not be filling the landfill at the same time.
And
So that's definitely
it's a
an
completely
area
different
of
issue for
research.
you too, doing it on a commercial scale, because the amount of labor that you have to do anything is so out of proportion with the size of the space that you're managing.
Yeah, yes, for sure. Yeah, you're right about that.
You did mention working with low input fruit systems. Do you have any thoughts on that aspect of managing things?
Yeah, fruits, in our area, fruit crops, we're in a high, like I mentioned, a high precipitation area. We have a lot of fungal issues and also high pest pressures. So my focus on in the fruit department, and we've been shifting this way at Baker Creek here, just on the farm here, is to shift away from a lot of the California fruits, your peaches and your nectarines, all of those, plums, even a lot of the apples. They require heavy fertility inputs, and even more importantly, they require heavy pesticide applications. But we do have a pretty good array of low maintenance fruits that grow here, and ironically, a lot of them are natives. A lot of them are natives, or else they are hybrids with natives. So we grow pawpaws, and a lot of them have been improved to have superior fruit. We grow persimmons, and a lot of them are hybrids between the khaki, the Japanese persimmon, and our native persimmon here, but they're grafted on the native persimmon rootstock. so they flourish in our soils. And they end up being a very, very good low input fruit source, both the pawpaw and the persimmons. And there are a few other miscellaneous crops. There are some mulberries that can give a lot of food value in our climate with low inputs, and some chia fruits, which are actually grafted on our native Osage orange. So it goes, it comes full circle to the native plants in a lot of cases with these low maintenance fruit crops.
I've wondered if there's more potential for interspecies hybridization with the persimmon genus, because the Asian and the American persimmons are just two species out of a very large genus that's all over the place. Like, we've got a couple of native species that are fairly edible in Australia. And there's also the black sapote, the chocolate pudding fruit.
Oh, yes.
And
Yeah,
the little.
it hasn't fully been exploited yet, I don't think, all those resources.
Yeah, I suspect that more interspecies hybridization in Diospyros has a lot of potential. And I'm hoping to do a little bit of it here once I get my trees mature.
Yes, yeah, you're right, I think. There's a lot to tap into in that genus.
It's going to be a nightmare, though, to do the hand pollination. Though at least there's some degree of separate male and female flowers, but yeah, it's going to be a lot of bagging and a lot of squinting and cursing when I drop pollen on the ground and out in the field.
So is your climate there? Do you have a temperate? Are you working in a temperate climate?
We're subtropical, so
Subtropical.
kind of like probably the closest approximation would be the eastern humid part of Texas,
Okay.
fairly close to the coast where you get crushing humidity and occasional droughts.
Sure, yes. Okay.
Yeah. So the other thing I love talking to people about is the social networking around crop breeding and farming. And because as we were saying before, often this plant breeding is done by very single-minded, very isolated people who, just spend their lifetime playing around in the garden. But getting that material and that work that they've done into the hands of others is often the rate limiting step. And it's often really tragic to see that a lifetime's work can just end up in a dusty box in somebody's estate sale. So, do you
Yes.
have any thoughts about how social organizations can kind of bring us together to, carry on our work and share inspiration and material?
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that we need to discuss and talk about. I've personally seen, I'm thinking of one instance at least, a very aged crop breeder, and he has some amazing products from his years of work. And I don't know if they're going to get passed on to anyone. No one is stewarding them right now that I'm aware of. And so that concerns me. I think that networking, I mean, a lot of networking these days happens on the internet, and that's a place to start. Many people, who are listening to this podcast may be aware of the Facebook group that's talking about develop it's I may butcher the name, but it's something about permaculture, breeding for permaculture.
Yeah.
And
I
you
think it's
probably have a
plant breeding for permaculture.
plant breeding for permaculture. I visit it all the time, but I don't have the name stuck in my head. So that's a great resource, I think, for those of us who are wanting to connect with others we're really in a niche field. There are not very many people doing this work. So it's great to tap into the others who are doing that and be able to rub shoulders. So I would say that's a great place to start. And I would say that Facebook group and also some of the other online forums, there's the Open Source Plant Breeding Forum. I think that some of these have a very high concentration of talent, really, of plant breeding talent. Some of it's amateur, some of it's more professional. But for anyone who's interested in this work, and if they haven't tapped into that, I would tap into that. Outside of that, I know there are plant breeding conferences. I have not attended a lot of those personally. I've attended larger events. I mean, here at Baker Creek, we've got several large garden shows throughout the year that attract a lot of people who are into permaculture and sustainable agriculture practices. And so there are a lot of broader events that people can attend, and I've attended some of those. As far as specific plant breeding in-person events. I know those happen as well, but I haven't been a part of most of them. Mainly, it's been the online networking that's helped me.
Well, we live at an amazing time in history where you can reach out to people over the entire planet. And if you've got
For sure.
a very
For
niche
sure.
interest, you can find those other people. Maybe some of the older generation missed out on that. Like they might not have adapted to the opportunities of technology. So yeah, if you find someone like that in your community who has been doing this work for a long time and they're kind of on their way out, consider trying to like take on their material and spread it more widely. I know I've done that locally. I found a woman from like the settler days who's been keeping a garden. She's in her 80s, she's blind, and she's still
Oh, wow.
gardening, and she's given me so much of her stuff that I've managed to propagate up and share it more widely.
Yeah, that's so neat when you find those kind of people. It's a treasure because you're right, a lot of them do not connect to the online platforms.
Now, also, I wanted to talk about what your thoughts are on the commercial seed market, because you've got an unusual perspective. And America is probably one of the more thriving parts of the world. Like, you've got the numbers, you've got the diversity of ecosystems, you've got the heritage as well. Like, you've got a very strong pre-industrial farming heritage that Australia kind of missed out on because we're the little sister. What are the challenges and opportunities in running commercial seed enterprises in the United States?
You know, there is a large market for there's a large market for sustainable and especially non-genetically engineered crop lines. And that's something that our company has been pretty strong on for quite a few, well, actually, since we began in 1998, we focused on open pollinated plants. And then, of course, stuff that has not been bioengineered. And there is a large market for that. You know, Baker Creek, we're not patenting anything we release. So when you're operating in that level of the market, it requires a little bit of a different structure because you have to be much more of a networker. You have to find things as they are released, and you have to celebrate them as you release them and let them act. You know, you basically you're gifting them to the public because you realize that other people are going to take those and they're going to make money on them too, but that's okay. And you're constantly curating, combing through what's out there, and then celebrating each new discovery as it comes. Because, you know, the traditional commercial way of doing things, and a lot of the universities here in the States as well, they release something and they patent it, you know, immediately. And I don't begrudge them for doing that, but it's a little different, just a little different philosophy. You know, we are combing through what's out there, what plant breeder really we're combing through what plant breeders all over are doing, and we cooperate with some of them. You know, they will sell their seeds through us, and we'll work with them, give them a commission of the profits. So it's a much more a networking approach to, you know, seed saving, and a more of an open source sharing, helping the breeders by selling their seeds, giving them an outlet for their seeds, but realizing that we're not going to control the future of what we release. So it's a little different. You've got these two paradigms, and we tend to focus on the open source side of the paradigms.
The strategy where people breed a new strain and then patent it almost feels like a self-fulfilling prophecy that they put so much money into the legal wrangling to get the patent set up that the extra money they make from the patenting kind of just pays for the legal shenanigans of the patenting. Like
Oh, sure.
you have to be in just the right circumstances. Like it has to be a really big release for it to be profitable to do all of that extra overhead with the legal structure.
Yeah, sure.
And even then,
Yeah, I see that.
I'm guessing patented strains, if they can be easily propagated, there's like little market farmers all over the place growing it off patent anyway. So are you going to run
Hard
around
to
trying to,
enforce.
yeah, how do you enforce it? Do you run around suing people for growing a potato? It's not a good look. So yeah, I think it's good to see that more open source approach to plant breeding winning out over time.
Yeah, and I will take the opportunity because we may be, there may be some plant breeders listening in, and if, as a company, we are looking for, we want to help you get your stuff to market. So if you have something that you're interested in working with us on, we love to talk to people. So I just wanted to throw that out there. We love to start those conversations.
Well, it's an interesting logistical issue at the moment. If you're a crop breeder and you only have like two or three things that you think are worth like scaling up and selling to the world, it's kind of not worth setting up a web shop and doing all the logistics of packaging and posting and keeping track of orders just for that
Yes.
small, like there's a critical mass that you need to build up to be a company. And yeah, having entities like Baker Creek that can act as a central hub for that activity. I think it's really amazing. I wish something like that happened more in Australia.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I'm curious, just a general thing, how volatile is the home seed market in? I'm just thinking because I had an experience with COVID recently that everyone went crazy buying packets of vegetable seed, thinking it was the end of the world, and then it all died down again on the other side
For
of it.
sure.
Do you see that kind of thing happen regularly?
Yeah, actually during COVID, Baker Creek saw explosive growth. That was before I was working here, but I've heard the stories. Everyone was realizing that they need something in their backyard that they can eat. And so, yeah, we saw an explosion in sales. I want to say sales doubled at least twice. So they are very volatile. It's affected by it's like the stock market in a way, very affected by consumer sentiment. Of course, you have people who have been at it for a long time that are your bread and butter people who have been doing it for years, but it is affected by consumer sentiment to a degree.
That's got to make it, well, it's another challenge in running a business to keep it going year after year.
For sure. For sure. Yep.
Now, we were chatting a bit before, and this is a topic I really want to touch upon. You mentioned that you are in religious communities, and I'm really curious if you have any thoughts on the interweaving of like plant breeding and home food production in religious communities, because I'm all about social networking, and I think they're a great example of a structure that has gotten so many things right. Like it's maintained traditions, it's adapted as times has changed as well. And yeah, it's not an area that I'm familiar with, and I'm really curious to get your thoughts and perspective on that.
Yeah, I think that plants and agriculture have definitely played a part in many cultures. Personally, growing up, I grew up doing gardens, and I grew up with a very strong faith background. And, being out in nature and being in gardens, it has a refining effect on people. It just has a different It has a different, a calming, like a calming, soothing effect on humanity. And I think that, I think it was designed to have that effect on us. It doesn't agitate us like the world at large does. And I think that many communities have seen that. And I think to this day that people do gardening for therapy. And it's had that effect in my life. Growing up, I would say personally, I've seen that, and I think I'm not alone in that, just from what I've observed.
Yeah, it's a big puzzle because our modern society is so good at dividing us into little tiny consumer units and pushing us around with advertising and propaganda.
For
And yeah,
sure.
I'm always looking at examples that have managed to resist at least some of that pressure. And yeah, I'm hopeful that one day I'll get to talk to somebody in, for example, like the Amish community. To if there's anyone plant breeding in that community, reach out to me because I don't even know how to start to make a contact on that front.
Yes, for sure. I do not personally know Amish doing plant breeding, but I'm sure there are some people. I know they do a lot of gardening and there's a lot of agriculture going on. So you're right in about the cultural aspect.
Yeah, it's a big unsolved puzzle, but I think it's part of what we're working on as crop breeders. We're opening up new possibilities. Now, rounding off with the final questions, what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
The future of food. Oh, that's a good question. You know, I see the health benefits of eating your own food, growing your own food. I see the health benefits from the nutrition standpoint. I see the health benefits from the lessened toxic load in the food we eat. But even more than that, I see the benefits from the lifestyle of being out in the garden. And I would say that any family with children, they need to have that experience. The kids need to have that experience. Yes, for eating the food, but even just for knowing where the food comes from, for being aware of ecosystems and being aware of, a part of life that really our society has disconnected us from. I would say that, especially for families with young children, having experienced that myself, growing up in the garden, growing up in nature, I see it as really indispensable. So I would say the vision is twofold. Yes, I think that humans thrive when they're eating healthy food, when they are lessening the toxic load that they are being exposed to, but also when they're living the lifestyle that I really think we were designed to live, when we are connecting with the life forms around us. So yeah, I see it as a dual benefit, especially for families.
It's amazing how many people I've talked to, they have a core childhood memory in the garden, and
Oh.
so much of that is behind them becoming, involved in these kind of activities of like devoting their whole life to breeding, even just one crop occasionally.
That's funny. Yeah, I know that I've heard similar stories about the poor experiences, but I think that if it's a lifestyle, I think the kids work through those. I think the kids work through those and they realize that there's something they want there.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions on who I should interview next?
You know, one person I did want to mention, I don't know if you've spoken to him yet, but Clifford England is a gentleman here in the United States who specializes in low input fruits. And this is stepping aside from the breeding topic just a little bit. But on the low input side of things, if you haven't had a chance to talk with him yet, I would say he's the authority on, or one of the authorities on low input fruits here in this part of the country. So yeah, he might be a good person to at least send a message to and
Yeah,
throw out the
he'll my
idea.
list. He's on my list. My ideal with fruit trees and shrubs is that you plant them, and then the only thing you have to do is come back and pick them. That's the ideal.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So if people want to learn more about your work or maybe get in touch, what's the best place to look you up?
Probably Facebook would be easiest. I've got Weston Adams, you'll find me on Facebook. I could also give my work email address just in case anyone wants to shoot an email over. My work email is weston.a. So that's weston dot a. And that's at rareseeds.com.
Cool.
So weston.a at rareseeds.com. If you want to shoot me an email, I'd be happy to chat. Love to hear from anyone.
Excellent. I'll put all of the details in the show notes so people can make sure they've got the details right. So thank you very much for talking to us. What is your final message for people thinking of getting into all of the kind of things you do?
I would say it's very fulfilling. I would say it's very fulfilling. And if you want to do it, it requires commitment, but it's rewarding. It requires follow through. Unlike many other things that we do in life, plant breeding is something that requires It requires years of follow through, but it's very rewarding because you get to see it build from year to year. You know, when I was younger, one of the things I liked about perennials is that you get to see build it, each year builds on the previous year. You don't start at the ground. And when even when you're working with annuals, when you get into crop breeding, you've got the same thing. Every year you're building on the last year, and that's so rewarding to see something new every year and to realize that you're making progress in the big picture. You're not just starting at ground zero. You are incrementally developing something that you can give to your children, you can give to the world at large, and you can make a difference to better the gardens of others.
Brilliant. That is such a wonderful point to round off on. Thank you so much for talking to us today, Weston. And maybe we'll catch up again sometime in the future.
Shane, it's been a pleasure. So much appreciate it.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.